glad to be back. You'll probably be able to tell that I still don't quite have my full voice back. My voice is a little hoarse, so I'll probably drink some water this morning. Bear with me. I'm excited to start with you this morning something that I thought I was going to be able to start last week, and that is a series of lessons that is going to carry us forward in the next several weeks. I thought it was going to be a series for July, but now it's July 10th. COVID, thank you. And so it'll be July / some of August. But we're going to look at a series that I'm calling God and the Prophets. Taking a look at some of the shorter prophetic works in the Old Testament and seeing what they tell us about the God that we serve. God revealed his will for his people through these prophets. And by understanding the will that he revealed to his people, we can understand more about him. The prophets tell us about the character of our God. They tell us who he is, what he loves, what he hates. And so although these books were written to specific audiences at specific points in time with specific contexts for those people, there are messages within them that are just as applicable to us as they were to their original hearers because they tell about the unchanging nature of our God. We're going to start today in the book of Lamentations and look at that relatively short book together for a few minutes. We won't be able to cover everything that could be covered by any means, but we'll do an overview and I hope learn some things that are helpful for us to consider. Lamentations is a short book that comes right after Jeremiah. And traditionally, it's been attributed to Jeremiah, although, as always, when it comes to authorships, there are other opinions and plausible possibilities. Lamentations is a fascinating piece of literature. It takes the form of five speeches, or five laments, five poems, kind of like a eulogy might be written and presented at a funeral. These laments, or these speeches, describe the horror and the grief that came in the aftermath of the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC. God had used the powerful and dreaded nation of Babylon to carry out very devastating judgment on his people. Jerusalem was besieged for over 2 years before it finally fell. There was famine and deprivation in the city during the siege that are described briefly in 2 Kings chapter 25 and quite graphically here in Lamentations. And after the walls fell, the city was plundered, and the temple of Solomon, the pride and joy of God's nation, was completely leveled. Groups of captives were taken away and dispersed across the Babylonian Empire. King Zedekiah of Judah was forced by the Babylonians to watch as his sons were killed before his eyes, and then the Babylonians took his eyes and led him away in chains to captivity. And much like the descriptions that Matt read for us in class some weeks ago about the second destruction of Jerusalem under Roman rule, I think it's impossible for us really to imagine the horror of the things that the people of Israel experienced. Jerusalem was destroyed. And in Lamentations, we get a taste of what they felt. It serves as a kind of as a lament over the grief of the people. It gives a voice to their suffering, to their sorrow, and to their acknowledgement that what happened to them happened for a reason. And so I'd like to read a few short sections with you. Here's what we're going to read, but they're going to be on the screen. We don't have time to read all, although I would encourage you, if you've never read through Lamentations, odds are we probably all haven't. If you've never read through Lamentations, I'd encourage you to do it. weep with those who wept, as it were. In the first speech, the speaker describes the aftermath, the grief, and the desolation that Jerusalem now finds herself in. Here are some selections from chapter 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people? How like a widow has she become, she who was great among the nations? She who was a princess among the provinces has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate, her priests groan, her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. For these things I weep. My eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. The Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. But hear, all you peoples, and see my suffering. My young women and my young men have gone into captivity. The second speech describes the horrors of the siege and the sacking of the city. The Lord has swallowed up without mercy all the inhabitants of Jacob. In his wrath, he has broken down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought down to the ground in dishonor the kingdom and its rulers. He has cut down in fierce anger all the might of Israel. He has withdrawn from them his right hand in the face of the enemy. He has burned like a flaming fire in Jacob, consuming all around. He has bent his bow like an enemy, with his right hand set like a foe, and he has killed all who were delightful in our eyes in the tent of the daughter of Zion. He has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord has become like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all its palaces. He has laid in ruins its strongholds, and he has multiplied in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. My eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach churns. My bile is poured out to the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because infants and babies faint in the streets of the city. Look, O Lord, and see, with whom have you dealt thus? Should women eat the fruit of their womb, the children of their tender care? Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? The third speech calls to mind the character of God in the book's first expression of any kind of hope, that he is loving and merciful, that he will not cast off his people forever. And the speaker cries out for repentance and asks God that judgment be extended to Judah's sinful enemies as well. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. He has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me he turns his hand again and again the whole day long. Remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. For the Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, he will have compassion, according to the abundance of his steadfast love. For he does not afflict from his heart or grieve the children of men. Let us test and examine our ways and return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. We have transgressed and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. You have wrapped yourself with anger and pursued us, killing without pity. You have wrapped yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can pass through. The fourth speech goes further in describing the horrors of the famine and acknowledges that this judgment is the result of sin, that the people deserved this judgment. And so in chapter 4, beginning in verse 4, the tongue of the nursing infant sticks to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The children beg for food, but no one gives to them. Those who once feasted on delicacies perish in the street. Those who were brought up in purple embrace ash heaps. For the chastisement of the daughter of my people has been greater than the punishment of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment with no hands wrung for her. Happier were the victims of the sword than the victims of hunger, who wasted away, pierced by the lack of fruits of the field. The hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food during the destruction of the daughter of my people. The Lord gave full vent to his wrath. He poured out his hot anger, and he kindled a fire in Zion that consumed its foundations. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor any of the inhabitants of the world, that foe or enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. This was for the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who shed in the midst of her the blood of the righteous. Finally, in the fifth speech, the speaker entreats God for relief, asks for restoration. But the book ends in uncertainty. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. Women are raped in Zion, young women in the towns of Judah. Princes are hung up by their hands. No respect is shown to the elders. The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned to mourning. But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us for so many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and you remain exceedingly angry with us. I think the book of Lamentations shows us a picture of God that we don't necessarily give enough attention to. Any picture of God that does not include an understanding of his righteous anger and his fearsome judgment over sin is incomplete. And I'll say that in the past, there may have been a tendency among Christians, not there may have been, there was a tendency among Christians to overemphasize the wrath of God and not give credit to his steadfast love and his mercy. But today, in many places, the opposite is true, and any concept of God's wrath is either downplayed or ignored. Or if it's discussed, it's painted as some kind of contrast between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. That the God of the Old Testament was angry and wrathful and vengeful, and the God of the New Testament is loving and merciful and compassionate. But the character of God does not change. His hatred of sin and his need for righteous justice have never changed. And the God who visited his people in this judgment in 589 BC is the same God in whose presence we stand today. And so we must know him and understand his character. We must fit the God of Lamentations into our understanding of who it is that we serve. because he has revealed this part of himself to us. And keep in mind, the people that we read about here in Lamentations, these are God's chosen people. This is the nation of Judah. This is the faithful remnant. This is his love, his prized possession. Chapter 2 describes the splendor of Israel being cast down from heaven to earth. His footstool he has forgotten. Imagine being one of the children of Israel, one of the people of Judah in Jerusalem, and undergoing a siege that lasted for 30 months. Imagine how many prayers were made, how many sacrifices were offered during those 30 months. Imagine being one of the children of God, praying for rescue, for deliverance, for salvation, and watching, waiting for it to come. In Lamentations, we see, I think, a picture of the just punishment for sin. Because God is against sin. And it's a remarkable thing in some of the verses that we read that not only does God not fight for his people in this judgment of Babylon, not only does God not fight for them, God is fighting against them. He becomes an enemy. The God who for so long had told his people, "Don't fear, I am with you. My right hand will hold you up. I will fight for you this day," has now become an enemy. And the speaker of Lamentations recognizes that it was ultimately not Babylon who broke down the walls and stormed the city, devoting it to destruction, just like the people of Israel had devoted Jericho to destruction so many years ago. It was not Babylon, but God, who was visiting judgment upon his own sinful city. If you want to see what the just punishment for sin looks like, look at Lamentations. Bodies, young and old, lying in the dust of the streets. The few that remain sitting in their vomit and tears, unable to forget the things that they have seen. The gold-painted stones of the temple scattered in the streets. No house for God, no sign of his presence, and no ark with its mercy seat. And Lamentations is really a strikingly dark book. There are expressions of hope, but they're few. And it doesn't even end in confident hope. It's not one of those books where it starts out negative and progresses to positive, and by the time you get to the end, you're all encouraged. No, it's just dark. And the question of Lamentations then, I think, becomes, how do we balance the hopelessness of this book with our understanding of who God is? Because that was the question for the people of Judah. The book struggles to balance the people's trust in the faithful love of their God with the desolation that is all around them before their eyes. That even with these expressions of faith and hope in various sections of the text, especially chapter 3, the ending is one of uncertainty. Restore us, O God, unless you've forsaken us forever. Unless you're still angry with us. They cry out for salvation, but they know that this judgment is just. And where does that leave them? So the speaker in chapter 3 and verse 26 calls for the people to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord, to wait quietly for his steadfast love and mercies to be revealed. They couldn't see it. They could only hope that there was a future. They could hope for restoration not because they deserved it, but because they believed in a compassionate God. One of the interesting things for me to look at is the way in which the person of Jesus answers questions that are raised or brought up in the Old Testament. We touched on this morning in class. Hebrews talks about Jesus being a mediator. In the book of Job, there are several questions that Job asks that are never really answered until you get to the New Testament and you find out about Jesus. Job goes before God and he asks how man can possibly be in the right before God. He asks whether God is able to sympathize with mankind's struggles. Job asks God for an arbiter, for a mediator. He says, someone who can lay his hand on both of us, lay his hand on God and lay his hand on man, be a go-between. Jesus is the answer to that question. Jesus is God in the flesh who can sympathize with our weaknesses, who can intercede for us with God on our behalf. He is the arbiter who can lay his hand on us both. He is the answer to Job's question. That's an example. But the entire book of Lamentations is a question. How can God's just and righteous anger against sin coexist with his faithful mercy and his steadfast love? How can those things be in harmony with each other? Because the author proclaims his faith in the love of God, but is at the same time forced to recognize that his people have rejected God and deserve this punishment. They believe in a faithful and merciful God, but they also understand their sin and his justice. And they hope for salvation, but can't see how or when it may come. They don't know it, but their hope is found in Jesus Christ. Because in Jesus Christ, that conflict finds its resolution. In the cross of Christ, we see how God's perfect love meets his perfect justice, and they are in harmony with one another. There is no conflict, because at the cross, the full force of God's righteous judgment is carried out. The debt for sin is paid in full. The guilt of all transgressions is laid on a substitute, on the shoulders of God himself in the flesh. And so by volunteering himself, God is able to accomplish justice and punish sin, while at the same time expressing his unbelievable love and faithfulness for creation. And so as Paul will say in Romans 3, in verse 25, at the cross, God shows himself to be just and the justifier. There are a number of connections, even of the language and the imagery, between sections of Lamentation and the messianic prophecies about the death of Christ, like Isaiah chapter 53, the suffering servant. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, he was crushed. The hand of God was against him. Even as God visited judgment upon his people in 587, he was looking forward to the time when he would take the punishment for sin upon himself. And so every time in the Old Testament that God steps in to administer justice or to uphold righteousness, to punish sin, it is but one more step toward the ultimate expression of justice and mercy in the cross of Christ. And so Jeremiah was right to call the focus of the people to the character of God. He is faithful. His mercies never come to an end, and his steadfast love never ceases. And God's people must place their trust in his character, because it will not fail, even when circumstances cloud our vision. There's a very short poem, really just a single verse, that you may have heard before. I'm familiar with it because when I was in chorus at Florida College, we sang a setting of it, a choral arrangement that was one of my favorite pieces we ever sang, called Even When He Is Silent. There was a poem found written on the wall of a holding area during the Holocaust, written by a Jewish victim. A three-line poem that said, "I believe in the sun, even when it's not shining. I believe in love, even when I feel it not. I believe in God, even when he is silent." Probably just because I've sung that song so many times, I have trouble with it, but I can hardly read the poem. "I believe in God, even when he is silent." Can you imagine the faith that it must have took someone to see the horrors of the Holocaust, to live it, to die in it, and to say to God, "I can't see you, I can't hear you, I don't know why this is happening, but I believe in you." It reminds me of the state of the people of God in Lamentations. That kind of real and raw, difficult faith. And if I can make a quick application, there may be times in our lives when the goodness of God is hard to see because we are so overwhelmed or blinded by circumstance. But faith, as we read in Hebrews, faith is the substance of things that we cannot see. Faith is what endures through grief or hardship when our prayers for relief seem to go unanswered. It is faith in the unchanging mercy and love of God that will endure. Faith in his purpose and his promise. And I think Lamentations is a reminder that faith is not some easy get out of jail free card. Faith is hard. It's especially hard when you're in the midst of darkness. But God knows that it's hard. And so just like we see Jeremiah and the people of Israel struggling with faith in Lamentations, we see Jesus in the garden weeping like drops of blood. That's faith. And it's realistic faith. It's difficult faith. Before we close, I want to show you one thing in the text that I think is cool. In chapter 1 and verse 12, one of the verses that we read earlier, the ESV says, "Is it nothing to you, all who pass by, look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me?" That first phrase in the book, Lo Alechem, the phrase in Hebrew is just a fragment. It's not a full thought. It's just the words, "not to you." And so there's some ambiguity in what the first phrase means. We don't know if it's a statement or a question. It could be that the speaker is crying out to those looking on Jerusalem and seeing its destruction and saying, you know, "May what has happened to us never happen to you. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy." That kind of thing. If it were an exclamation or a statement, that might be the translation. But most of your translations won't render it that way, because that doesn't seem to fit with the flow of thought in the coming verses. Verses in the future in the book will look forward to God visiting his just judgment on the surrounding nations that are watching Jerusalem and rejoicing. Chapter 1 and verse 22, for example, "Let all their evil doing come before you and deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my transgressions." So the speaker knows that his judgment is just. He knows that it is a result of sin, but he still asks God to bring the same judgment on the sinful people that are mocking his suffering. So in the immediate context of Lamentations, Lo Alechem probably doesn't mean, "May this never happen to you." But it's ambiguous. And so most of the translations will translate it something like, "Is it nothing to you?" In other words, are you who are watching, do you dismiss my pain? Is it meaningless in your sight? Is it nothing to you? Are you not driven to pity this, the greatest sorrow and suffering that you have ever seen? But what I'd suggest to you is that even here in Lamentations 1 and verse 12, we see a suffering servant, Jeremiah, maybe, the author, who, when he is reviled, he cries out for vengeance. When he suffers, he calls out for God's justice to be carried out on those who are watching him suffer. And even in these words, he asks God to deal with others likewise as God has dealt with him. But there's an echo, I think, of a future suffering servant who is a better suffering servant who, as Isaiah says, when he is reviled, does not revile in return. Or as Jesus said on the cross, when he is mocked and spat upon, he says, "Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing." Jesus, who will bear the full weight of God's wrath and judgment, so that all those who pass by may not have to go through it themselves. And so instead of crying out that his suffering be matched by those around him, Christ suffers so that others can escape. And so that ambiguous phrase in Lamentations chapter 1 and verse 12 takes on a more impressive meaning in light of Christ, because he, in reality, looks at those around and says, "May it never be for you." That's the sacrifice that has been made for us. Lamentations, I think, gives us a picture of a just punishment for sin. And it shows us the terrible wrath of a God whose patience and grace have been rejected time and time again. But even as it shows us the wrath of God, it points us forward to look for God's mercy, to anticipate some relief, some new manifestation of his steadfast love, some resolution of this conflict that his people felt between their knowledge of his uncompromising righteousness and his unending love. It points us to Christ. And let's praise God that we can now understand this mystery, that we can see and understand this great plan that he set in motion before the foundation of the world for the salvation of his people, that it has come and we have access to it through Christ. And so, what the people of God struggled to confess through doubts and fears and lamentations, we should be able to proclaim boldly and with confidence, because we know that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end, but they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Amen.